Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook with Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. Each Thursday, we speak with Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina, and he is the national expert on waivers and exemptions for and vaccine rights. He is an advocate, a promoter, an educator, and he is on the cutting edge of whatever is happening in the nation. And I assume, Alan, that you get information about what's happening in each state.
I get information that comes to me from all over the country and around the world on the vaccine issue. In my practice, I work with people around the country. And I tell you, Debbie, I don't know why I continue to be surprised by this, but there's so much going on all over the country and around the world on this issue, just continually, it seems.
Yes, I agree with you, and I was just expressing that feeling of actually joy that people are awakening up to this issue and want to take back their rights and want to become educated and want to become responsible for their own health. On Facebook, on one of the vaccine groups, I was just reading that the state bill was introduced in Oklahoma. It's another good bill has been introduced requiring healthcare facilities to grant religious exemptions to flu vaccine mandates. And I have the link to that on Homeopathy World Community on today's notes for today's show. And everything is always posted on the NVIC advocacy portal, which is the National Vaccine Information website. So one of the comments that was written from this was by a guy named Michael Moss. I don't know who he is. He said, "I don't like these exemptions. They're a capitulation in essence, admitting the state is superior and has won, that finding a few loophole exemptions is our only way out. It assumes that everyone else taking the shot is default setting normal. The default setting should be that this is my body and my choice." And I responded to him saying, this is basically typical procedure today. Everything is to opt out, as opposed to, yes, I want to join this, I want to opt in. If you go to Facebook, it's the same way. It's a complaint that I've had all along. What do you say to that?
Forgive me, Debbie, I missed the last part of that, what you were saying. Sorry, I got distracted momentarily here with something.
Okay, I was basically saying that in response to all of these bills that are providing rights for people to sign an exemption or a waiver, which I'm calling an opt-out, religious or philosophical or personal or medical exemptions are a way to opt out of a mandate. And he doesn't like that idea. He says all of these exemptions, they're capitulation, they're admitting that the state is superior and has won, and finding these loophole exemptions is the only way out. He assumes that everyone else is taking the shot is a default setting normal. And he says the default setting should be, this is my body, this is my choice. And so I just thought it was an interesting way of looking at it.
Well, Debbie, it's a really good point that you bring up here, because I see a lot of confusion in the alternative health community about the status. For example, a lot of people say, well, vaccines aren't really mandated because there are exemptions. And that's a misleading and, I think, bottom line, incorrect assessment, at least legally. Legally, the starting place is, as you put it, that they are mandated. And the question is then, are there exceptions of any kind, typically called exemptions or waivers? And can you qualify for one if there is? And the bottom line is, not everybody can qualify for an exemption in every situation where vaccines are mandated. And yes, I think it is a fair general assumption that the people who are not opting out, as you say, who are not finding and qualifying and exercising an exemption, presumably everyone else is getting the vaccines. And it's a real important distinction, because people in this arena often confuse what they think their rights should be with what their rights actually are. And I would agree 100% with the gentleman that we got it backwards in terms of the policy and law, that we should absolutely be starting from a place of personal autonomy, personal right, personal freedom to decide what goes into your body or not, and that of your children. And it ought to be the other way around, that the starting place is that you are presumed to have that choice. And then if you choose to exercise the right to get a vaccine, that's your choice. But it should not be something that's the starting place is a mandate, and the question is, can you opt out? But, of course, that's the current legal status. And ultimately, we need to shift policy and law to a place where there are no mandates anywhere in with routine immunizations or in emergencies. Because as we've talked before, when a state of emergency is declared, the legal landscape changes and rights change right along with it. So we ought to have the right in any situation to make that choice. We don't under current policy and law, and that's very disturbing to those of us who see the underlying corruption, conflicts of interest, and other non-scientific bases that are the basis for current policy and law.
And I have some comments regarding basic, natural law, universal law, and the practice of medicine. One is that what we're understanding about not only human nature, but nature in essence, is that when you apply force to something, there is going to be resistance. Maybe you could call it physics. Okay, but we can also call it biology. We can see that, and we're learning, if you didn't get the message yet, that when you try to annihilate something, when you try to put a pesticide, a spray, or a stop something from functioning, like these vaccines are going to burst the membrane, or they're going to stop the process, and you're going to go in and manipulate it, the innate survival mechanism of that living organism is to find a way to go around it, to survive, to mutate. And these organisms, the viruses, the bacteria, can mutate so much quicker than we could play around in the lab for 10 years to find something, that there's no way we're going to win this war. So it's basically going to be going with the flow, learning how to live in harmony with nature. And love is going to conquer all rather than hate. So I have a couple of quotes that I love to have some quotes in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. from I Have a Dream. He says, "Faith is taking the first step even when you can't see the whole staircase." So sometimes, you know, in medicine, you don't see the underlying, the DNA or whatever it is, but you see the response with your own eyes in nature of what works and what doesn't. And when we use homeopathy, it works. When we use antibiotics and antihistamines and all the anti, the negative, the suppressive, the forceful things, it's going to stop it temporarily. But then it's going to come back in full force, like rebound effect. It's going to be stronger when it pushes back against you. That's just one idea. And the other one is, our lives begin, this is another quote from Martin Luther King Jr., our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. And I think that today we're hearing the voice of the people, which is really beautiful. We are coming together and learning about all the issues that you talk about legally for gaining our rights. I'm taking up the whole show. Go ahead and...
You're doing great, Debbie. You're doing great. Okay. I want to make one quick comment, because you said something about we're just not going to win it that way. And I just want to add a brief clarification there that I am sure that I'm correct when I'm saying that you didn't mean to say we're not going to win against infectious disease in the sense that we just have to live with getting sick all the time or whatever, you know, as happened in the early 1900s and mid-1900s from these different childhood infectious diseases. By learning to work with nature, we can achieve the same end goal as is intended by the use of antibiotics and vaccines and other things that seem to have maybe at best some temporary success, but ultimately maybe making things worse instead of better. And perhaps multiple levels, you know, the use of antibiotics creating resistant strains of bacteria, for example, or we do have some recent news stories talking about, for example, pertussis outbreaks in highly vaccinated populations. Is that because it's a whole different germ or strain of the bacteria, which it may be? And is that something that has been caused in any way by vaccines? And some people believe, yes, that it has. So however noble the intent may have initially been, vaccines many, many years ago when the concept was first developed, because I think in more recent years the intent is anything but noble. The intent at best is simply to is a greed-based, money-based goal, and perhaps worse if you get into some of the potential underlying theories behind that. But we have many, many different things going on, Debbie. Let's see if we can touch on a few of them briefly before the hour flies by. There is a recent court case in Rhode Island, in Federal District Court in Rhode Island. There's a healthcare worker union suing the health department. The health department enacted a rule, a formal word there would be promulgate, agencies promulgate administrative rules or regulations, same thing, as opposed to...
I'm sorry, can you tell me again, which article is this?
This is not an article. This is a lawsuit going on in Rhode Island, and I have a copy of the complaint in front of me, but I don't believe that I have an article up about this yet. But I did just want to mention it briefly, because it's a healthcare worker union suing the State Department of Health. So the Department of Health creates this regulation having to do with mandatory flu vaccines and mask policies. And for every violation of the policy, if you don't have the vaccine and you're not wearing your mask all the time and they catch you, for every violation, you'll be fined $100. So they have a very strong incentive for people to comply with this policy, whether it makes sense or not, whether they agree with it or not, whether it's scientifically sound or not. So a couple of attorneys put together a complaint here on behalf of the healthcare workers union and filed it, and I'm not going to try to go over it in detail. It's a it looks like about an 18-page complaint, but there are some very interesting points here that I think have implications for the rest of the country, some of which.
Okay.
They have seven what they call counts in the complaint, where they're saying, here's the list of the violations. You know, the complaint starts out saying, here are the facts, and now here are the legal violations, what we're asking the court to find to be a breach of the law by this new healthcare regulation. So, for example, there are several that at least two or three or four here in reference to the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And they're saying here that plaintiffs, the union, the members have a fundamental right to pursue their profession under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And with regard to the mask policy in particular, it's essential for a doctor, nurse, social worker, or other healthcare worker that the patients feel safe in their care and that the workers and patients are open to communicate one another and that the patients trust the healthcare worker. And they accomplish this with open communication and facial expressions in large part. And wearing a mask impedes the healthcare worker's ability to gain the trust and to communicate openly and to make the patient feel safe. I thought that's really, I think it's absolutely valid. And I think it's really interesting. Now, if it were
So I know what they're going to do. They're going to create a mask that you can see through it.
Maybe. But just the fact that some of these people are wearing masks and others are not, that makes you think, well, why are you wearing a mask? Are you sick? Am I going to get sick if I'm around you or something like that? And right. And then, of course, the communication itself. Now, if it were just a question, if it were clear, cut and dry that the mask policy was medically and scientifically justified and necessary, I don't think an argument like that would work. But this complaint is also complaining that there's just no science backing up the policy. And so when you take that together with the idea of needing to be able to communicate with your patients, so that's one I hadn't heard before, this complaint, as a reason to oppose mask policies. Now, due process also includes things like if you're found, you know, not wearing your mask when you're supposed to, it's an automatic fine right then and there. Well, due process requires you to have the opportunity to tell your side of the story. And you're not just instantly guilty of a crime or liable under a civil,
not
as opposed
guilty
to criminal.
Until proven, not guilty until proven, no? What is it?
Innocent until proven guilty. Let's
thank you.
Like that.
Thank you.
Now, that as an analogy, of course, because that's a criminal principle, and we're talking civil here, not criminal, but the same basic idea applies. You have due process rights in civil or criminal law. So it's just really interesting some of the ways that they're approaching this. There's also talking about due process under the Rhode Island State Constitution, issues there. They're talking about equal protection. Regulations treat healthcare workers who are not immunized differently than those who are immunized. And healthcare workers who do not receive the vaccine are required to wear a surgical mask during a period in which the flu is declared to be widespread, while those who receive the flu vaccine are not required to wear masks. Well, we'll see how that plays out. But they're saying in the absence of scientific evidence correlating mask use with a reduction in flu transmission, the regulations do not serve a compelling state interest. And this is the legal standard that they have to meet.
The
regulations do not serve a compelling state interest.
Explain that one.
Well, it's a legal standard. If you introduce regulation that does not serve a compelling state interest, then you treat people differently, then that would potentially, and this is what the allegation and the complaint is saying, be a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So they say it lacks a substantial relationship to any important state interest. Of course, the state is saying you have to wear these masks to protect patients. And what this complaint is doing is calling them on that BS. I mean, this is interesting. I spend a great deal of time working.
So they're saying that it's the use of the mask is to protect the rest of the patients in the hospital, not specifically the doctors among each other or the doctors to the patients.
Well, the health department's primary concern is going to be patients. But, of course, if you're not wearing a mask under mainstream beliefs or assertions, you're putting everybody else at risk, patients in particular, but everybody, anybody and everybody in the hospital.
So is that like assuming that the doctor who was not immunized is sick? Is that what it's saying?
No, it assumes that they are capable of transmitting the flu while the vaccinated person is not.
Okay.
And that's really pretty silly when you think about it, because anybody, vaccinated or not, can touch a doorknob and pick up flu germs or can breathe in and out flu germs. And the masks, according to the CDC, masks will stop large droplet particles from a cough or sneeze, but they won't stop germs in the air. Germs are just much, much smaller than viruses in particular, much, much smaller than the largest holes at a microscopic level, whatever that is. But, you know, masks are not solid. In fact, they have to be designed so that the person wearing the mask can still breathe. So air gets in and out, and if air gets in and out, germs get in and out. So the whole idea that getting a flu shot or wearing a mask is going to stop transmission of the flu is just silly. Would be a polite word for it. My point here, though, what I think is so novel about this complaint is this is the first time that I've seen a lawsuit that is taking the science and medicine on this on head on. I do, when I work with clients with religious exemptions, we circumvent those issues because religion, where religion is concerned, those issues are somewhat irrelevant. You know, the law seems religion and science as more or less mutually exclusive realms, and you're not dealing with the science. I mean, the science is not irrelevant to a religious exemption because the law is not going to allow somebody to be exempt for religious or any other reason if it's going to create a significant health problem. But when you're dealing with a religious exemption, you're not taking these kinds of issues on head on for the most part. You're taking a different path to avoiding the vaccine. So this is just a real interesting complaint, and it's going to be very interesting. I'm going to do my best to keep tabs on this and find out how this case plays out. And
So it will apply to healthcare workers all over the country, really as a precedent?
Well, I think it has potential implications. You know, it's in one district, federal district court in Rhode Island, and strictly speaking, let's say this case plays out to conclusion as opposed to there being some settlement along the way. And let's say the case came down in favor of, the ruling came down in favor of the union. That would certainly be some precedent, legal precedent, that could have echoes all over the country in terms of how it affects healthcare policy, exemption policies, mask policies, and so forth. So this is going to be a really interesting case to watch. On the flip side, because ultimately you never know, you know, how court cases are going to play out. To one degree or another, any court case is a roll of the dice. You know, it's at least hypothetically possible that this case continues on to conclusion and there's a ruling that's really in favor of the health department, and that could have implications as well, just not the ones I'd like to see. So, but, well, you know, I'll come back with updates as I have them. We'll have to see. Just one other quick point, because I have a lot of people ask me, are there HIPAA implications? The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which has a lot of, this is federal regulations and laws that have a lot of protection for the privacy of healthcare information. When you make someone wear a mask, you're announcing to everybody that this person is not vaccinated. Is that a HIPAA violation? Interesting question. And
well, maybe they'll make everybody wear a mask then.
Well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see. But I don't, you know, from my point of view, when I'm working with people with religious objections, we don't challenge the mask policy in an absolute sense, which appears to be the case of what they're doing here in this complaint. We challenge it on a level of if it's excessive, if it's used for purposes of coercion or punishment, which is what's going on most of the time with these mask policies. The vast majority are way over the top. And yes, that's really what they're being used for, coercion or punishment, and that's discriminatory. So if the reason you're wearing a mask is because you have religious objections to the flu vaccine, and then they're telling you you've got to wear your mask all 12 hours of your shift for 8 months out of the year, which at least two nurses have told me that's what they were told, you know, that's just so over the top that it's discriminatory. It's unlawful. But a reasonable legal standard, whether or not it's a reasonable scientific standard is another question, but a reasonable legal standard is the CDC's position on that. And they say healthcare workers should wear a mask when they, the healthcare worker, have symptoms, or if they're working with a patient, you know, that has symptoms. But not just carte blanche, you know, all through your shift, you know, and good luck trying to eat with a mask on and so forth. Anyway.
Right. That was pretty interesting, and we're looking forward to seeing what happens with it. I think just the concept of a mask itself has so many connotations. You know, you can think of Zorro. You can think of the doctor. You can, all the people who wear a mask, you can think of a bandit or a robber, somebody who is either trying to hide something or, you know, their identity, or trying to use it as a form of protection. So I think that the mask itself is really got a lot going with it.
Well, we'll see how this case plays out, and I'll come back with updates as I get them.
Okay. Did you want to go ahead on to some other, you know, I was very happy and surprised, actually joyful that I, on your list of news items, you have been mentioned in the media quite a bit.
ABC did an article recently, and the journalist called me, and somebody informed me yesterday that that article was quoted in a Mercola,
yes,
Dr. Mercola article. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm deeply disturbed by, or troubled, let me not say disturbed, troubled by both the ABC article and Mercola's quoting it, because the journalist misquoted me in the ABC article and put out information that potentially could cause problems for healthcare workers all over the country. So I want to take a minute here to clear the air on that point. The article.
Let's document this right now so that they can get the message.
Yes.
Okay.
The article quotes me as saying that the law, referring to Title VII of the 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act, and this is about discrimination in the workplace, and as it pertains to religious discrimination in the workplace, and therefore what specifically what would qualify for a vaccine religious exemption for employees, healthcare worker or otherwise. They quoted me as saying that the law is so broad that it protects any sincerely held belief. And what I said to the journalist was exactly the opposite of that,
uh-huh.
That the law is very broad, but it does not protect any sincerely held religious belief. What it does, I mean, any sincerely held belief. What it
does not
protect,
okay.
What it does protect is any sincerely held belief that is religious or religious in nature as the law defines it. But that is, and it is very broad. I mean, the Title VII is so broad, there is literally even a category of beliefs that you could hold as an atheist that are protected religious beliefs. It's quite fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not protect any sincerely held religious beliefs. And what I see in this arena in particular is that when people try this on their own, they almost always wander into one or more of what I call legal pitfalls that cause them to be rejected when they are applying for an exemption because of exactly this issue. They include things that the law does not protect as a religious belief, and then they end up, although to them, and this is not a criticism of anybody, it's just kind of a quirk in terms of how the law works. The way the law works in this arena, On the one hand, in terms of who can potentially qualify, it's exceedingly broad. With regard to these specific beliefs that qualify, most people fall into one or more of what I call legal pitfalls when they attempt this on their own, when they operate from, they're coming from a very reasonable common sense point of view. It's just because the law is tricky in terms of the way it works. And the single, I'll go ahead and give away one of my secrets, if you will, in terms of this list of what I call legal pitfalls. By far, the single biggest mistake legally and practically that people make when they do this on their own is they talk about vaccine safety and effectiveness. And there are some arguments, legal arguments, on both sides of the issue here. But the practical reality is if you ask for a religious exemption and in your statement of beliefs you are criticizing or raising issues and concerns about vaccine safety, I can just about guarantee that you're going to get rejected. Is there a potential legal argument? Yes, there is. But the practical reality is that at best it's an uphill climb and most likely you're going to get rejected. So just one example. There are several others. And so I was just really concerned. I mean, Mercola didn't do anything wrong. All he did was quote the article as ABC published it. So I sent an email this morning to their marketing department. I hope it gets to somebody who can take some corrective action. But the ABC person, I'm sorry to say, and I'm sure it was quite unintentional, but got that piece wrong. So for anyone who saw that article, no, the law does not protect any sincerely held belief. It protects only a sincerely held religious belief as the law defines that term. Not a short answer question.
Well, how you make the phrase and the statement has to be exact, right on. It has to really say what it is. And you can't mix up the words. You can't leave out a word. You have to actually be very clear about it, which you are and you always have been. But sometimes, you know, people can accidentally hear the wrong thing. Or, you know, it's like the game of telephone. You say it. You repeat it incorrectly if you haven't documented it and, you know, give it to you first and get the okay. Is this what you said? You know, maybe they should do that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, it's tricky because a lot of times when you're interviewing somebody, you're writing or typing at the same time that you're listening to them talk about whatever it is you just asked them. And so I don't mean any disrespect for the author of the article there. I'm sure she's a fully competent professional who does a good job. But that my concern is not about criticizing anybody. My concern is that a misrepresentation is out there. And if people read that and say, oh, it doesn't matter what I say as long as I really believe it, you know, as long as I'm sincere, then there could be a lot of people out there trying to get exemptions on their own thinking it looks very straightforward and simple. It's not. It really is not. I had two or three different nurses come to me in the last year or two where one in particular stands out. She said she was told by a hospital administrator that the hospital system, this would have been, you know, more than one hospital, but the system had received over 1,000 requests for exemptions and the hospital had allowed 4. Now, I see two main issues in this arena generally around the country, and one of them is that most hospitals are implementing unlawfully restrictive policies, so they're excluding people who qualify. And that's part of the reason that only 4 out of 1,000 or more, you know, qualified at that particular hospital. It would have been a year before this most recent fall. But the other reason is because there are these legal pitfalls I keep talking about where people can do something that seems very reasonable to them from a common sense point of view, and it turns out that legally it either doesn't qualify or is tricky in one way or another. So it is an area, and I know this sounds self-serving, but I mean this from the bottom of my heart, it is an area where if it's really important to you, it's best to work with an attorney. And I've seen a certain amount of cat and mouse going on here. Hospitals have become more savvy and more sophisticated in the way that they're dealing with these exemption issues. So it's becoming, they're educating themselves on the law, sometimes at my prompting. when I call to their attention, by the way, your policy violates law, let's take a step back and get us all on the same page here. But they look for ways, of course, to reject exemptions so they can maximize their immunization rates. But otherwise, a terrific article, as always, from Dr. Mercola. I'm a big fan of Mercola. He's a tremendous educator and powerhouse in the arena.
I do want to let folks know, if they are listening in with us today, that the chat is open. I opened it a little bit late, and you can call in to 347-945-6956 if you would like to talk or make a comment, or you can click that blue Skype button from anywhere around the world. So I'd like to let folks know that this can be an interactive kind of session to talking. So was there a specific item that you wanted to get to?
Yes, I just came to my attention just in the last few days that there's a bill in Oregon changing the exemption laws there. Somebody had emailed me concerned that they were trying to get rid of the religious exemption. I finally had a chance to read the language of this bill last night, or at least a couple of relevant parts of the bill. And it looks to me, Oregon right now, currently, has an unconstitutional religious exemption law for schools. They require membership, at least the language of the law, requires membership in an organized religion. There's still several states, a few to several states around the country that have laws like this. This kind of law has been challenged in states and state and federal courts at least five times in the last, I don't know, couple of decades or so, and every time they get challenged, they're held to be unconstitutional. You cannot require church membership as a condition for an exemption. So people who live in states where those laws are still on the books can potentially exercise an exemption without being a member of an organized religion, but you've got a challenge in doing that because, of course, officials are going to say, well, the law says you can't do that. But I've had success working with some clients where we have an attorney write a letter that, you know, and that's often me, pointing out that the law is unconstitutional, so they can't enforce that part of it. And sometimes we have success with that. But the current bill in Oregon is the Senate Bill 132. It removes the word religious, but it appears to allow parents to refuse vaccines as long as they do an educational procedure. I would, you know, myself personally would put the word educational in quotes because, of course, what they want you to do is hear about what an awful, terrible person you are for not vaccinating, and aren't you sure, don't you want to really get the vaccines instead of be a bad person? You're putting everyone at risk and blah, blah, blah. Have to either go through a lecture from a doctor or some other course online. Thank God they weren't limiting it to just doctors as they did in Washington State. But they don't specify religious or otherwise, and so it looks to me like it's going to be a law that is similar to the California law in that it's not specifying the nature of the objection. So that would mean it would encompass both religious and philosophical objections, far more likely than not. I think that's a good thing on the level of it appears to be opening up the door for philosophical exemptions. I think that's a good thing. However, I think it's unconstitutional as phrased right now because as to those people who would be opting out for religious reasons, the First Amendment only requires that you have a belief that is religious in nature and sincerely held. And while a state could go more lenient than what the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution requires as a minimum standard, in other words, they could say, we'll even allow you to have a religious exemption if it's not religious in nature or if it's insincerely held. I mean, not that any state would ever do that for a religious exemption, but theoretically, the point is they could be more lenient than the federal law requires, but they can't be more restrictive than what the federal law requires because federal law is the higher legal authority, and the First Amendment applies to state and local governments as well as the federal government. So I think strictly or technically speaking, the bill is, if it were passed into law, the law would be unconstitutional as to those people who would be objecting on religious grounds. They cannot be required to go through a lecture about vaccines under the First Amendment as I understand it. There was also another clause near the end of this bill that says private schools can be more restrictive than what the state is doing. And that just sort of opens the door for private schools to say, we're not going to accept the exemption at all, or we're only going to accept this exemption if you're a member of a religious organization or something like that. And those, of course, would be unconstitutional restrictions. So I think that language at the end of the bill is also problematic. So we'll see if we can work with some legislators in Oregon and get those parts of the bill fixed, although my experience in the past is that while there ought to be a constitutional filter in every state and the federal legislature, no law should be able to, or no bill should be able to come up for a vote until it is screened by a committee that is looking at it, constitutional expert attorneys who are looking at it to see, are there any constitutional issues here? And if so, the bill should be sent back to the drafters before it ever comes up for a vote. But obviously that doesn't happen, because we've seen over and over again that unconstitutional laws get passed. We saw that in Washington State. We've seen it in North Carolina. We've seen it in California. We saw it in Vermont. New Mexico changed their religious exemption law recently, and I don't think the law is unconstitutional on its face, but the implementation of the law appears to be unconstitutional because they're not applying the law equally to everybody in the state.
And would this be a new procedure that would have to be enacted to go through this screening filter process to make sure that bills that are proposed are constitutional? And who would be the judge of that?
Well, you'd have to have constitutional experts. You'd have to have attorneys who know constitutional law. It would not be a foolproof system. Not everybody knows everything about every inch of the Constitution, but it would be a way to keep some of these blatantly unconstitutional bills from getting into law that have gotten into law. You know, a law that lets a minor consent to a vaccine, this is not a subtle constitutional point. We have a decades, if not many decades, if not centuries, long history of parental rights and parents' constitutional right to an obligation and responsibility to rear their children. You can't give that kind of authority even to you. I say you, the state, cannot take away a parent's right to raise their children, just collectively all parents in the state, and give it to anybody, not even another adult, with rare exceptions. If there's an emergency, a medical emergency, of course a doctor can treat the child before tracking down the parents while the child potentially suffers or dies.
It sounds like I don't want to say communist state. I don't want to say what kind of a state would it be that removes the rights of the parents to have the guardianship and decision-making power for their children's health?
Well, I think there are potentially different labels that apply, but whatever label you use, what we see here in this arena and other arenas as well, it's not unique at all to this arena. We're living in a very disturbing time in this country where people don't see what's going on, but it's going on anyway. And this is what happened in Nazi Germany. And I used to think that was a really extreme analogy, but I have increasingly over time seen it as a less and less extreme analogy, because we're moving in a direction where rights are being increasingly and more rapidly taken away. We live in a country where the federal government is attempting to disarm the citizens while the federal government itself is arming itself to the teeth. I don't want to get too far off the topic of vaccines, but what's going on and this has happened in other countries in the past. We need to take a look at the history here and see what happened in those countries. When you take away everybody's guns and then you create domestic armies, which is happening here in this country, the military is not supposed to be able to be involved in any sort of domestic matters. But we have the federal government, I had one piece of information said, just contracted for 450 million rounds of hollow point bullets. The hollow point bullets are bullets that are designed to be very efficient at killing, and they're more expensive. It's not something you buy for target practice. What does the federal government need 450 million rounds for? You know, what are they planning for? And this is, Department of Homeland Security stuff, you know, for the internal matters, not the U.S. military that I'm talking about here, buying it for, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever else might be going on internationally. So a lot of
we will, have to ask Greg when he gets on about this.
Be a good, a very good question for Greg. Anyway, we'll see what happens. You know, the constitutional argument ought to be a make it or break it for a bill, because legally, and on an analytical legal level, it is. Legally, a state legislature cannot pass a bill if it's unconstitutional. But I shouldn't say legally. The legal technicality is that a law is presumed to be constitutional unless a court says otherwise. And that technicality leaves open the door for state senators and representatives to pass any law, whether it's constitutional or not, because of this technicality that it is constitutional unless a court says otherwise. But the idea that they can just throw their oath to the wind, every state legislator takes an oath to uphold the state and federal constitutions. You know, to say that, oh, I'm not, you know, violating my oath because any law we pass is deemed to be constitutional until a court says otherwise, that does not pass the smell test. I'm sorry, you can argue it as a technicality, but it's lacking integrity, it's dishonest, it's disingenuous, it's corrupt. When you have a law that allows children to consent to vaccines, you know, that's not something you're letting go on a technicality there, because we really don't know if it's constitutional or not until the court looks at it. No, that doesn't fly. That is corruption, and it is present in this country and throughout the country, and laws are being passed that are unconstitutional in rapid succession on this and other issues, but on the vaccine issue. And bills are coming up in state after state.
How many other people are in your situation who are lawyers, who are advocates for vaccine rights and exemptions, who are knowledgeable about constitutional law, who are standing up and putting their energy and efforts? I mean, you've been doing it for a decade. Who else is out there, you know, standing with you and behind you?
There are a number of attorneys around the country who are concerned about this issue. I am the only one I know of who is regularly and sometimes directly or very nearly directly. Sometimes I work with and through activists, for example. On the legislative arena, anywhere and everywhere the issue comes up that I become aware of it, and if someone wants my help, I will help them on it. I'm certainly not the only attorney in the country concerned about vaccine issues. There are many of us, and several have contacted me in recent months, but I don't know anybody else who's focused on this issue in the way I am in terms of the practice, and who's focused on the legislative issues going on around the country and seeking to actively participate in those processes and actively participating in many of them.
Right. I think you need to start. I mean, this is a Debbie talking.
build
more people, mentor more people, guide more up and coming lawyers to say, you know, if this is a concern of yours, constitutional law, and the vaccine rights issue specifically, so that you have a larger network of people that can work together and form a coalition.
Well, there's been some discussion about that, Debbie. It's a great idea. If you don't hear me talking about that in the near future, you have my not only my permission, but my request that you give me a boot in the rear to see that I move forward on this idea, because you're absolutely right.
I say it because, you know, we're all not going to live forever, and this is going to be a continuing process, and I want you to get some vacation time too.
Well, I've had attorneys contact me asking, you know, interested in what I do and asking how they can get into it, and so I've been looking into that. I don't have a quick, easy answer to that question, but we're looking into it. And you're right, and I've actually been talking with some people recently about the same idea, but it's at the idea stage, a coalition of attorneys. But we have some attorneys and people with Juris Doctorate degrees on the Pandemic Response Project professional panel. We just need to expand on that and maybe pull together a subgroup that we could work with as a group in the legislative arena. It would be great to be able to pull the pull from the resources of more than one attorney. And, you know, the fantasy of taking a month off is very appealing to me. I have not even been able to take a week off anywhere because there's just too much to do to keep going. So as you know as well, if not far better than me, those of us who are active in promoting awareness, many of us really do have to take care to pace ourselves so we don't burn out, and I will certainly do my best to do that. But let's move on here. We've got just a few minutes left. Why don't we just touch on real quickly, if we can, a few of the many different very interesting vaccine news articles. Were there any that did you have a chance to look, and did you find any that got your attention, Debbie?
Yeah, I looked at all of them. I was busy all night reading.
Wow.
One of the things that I saw was the future apocalyptic scenario. I don't know whether this was on your side or not. The apocalyptic scenario for medicine and health. And did you happen to see that one?
I'm not sure I did, but it sounds fascinating. Please do tell.
Okay, antibiotic-resistant diseases pose apocalyptic threat. And this is the chief medical officer, Dame Sally Davies, tells MPs issue should be added to National Risk Register of Civil Emergencies. Obviously, this comes from The Guardian from the UK. And we're looking at an increase. It says the apocalyptic scenario where people going for a simple operation in 20 years' time die of routine infections because we have run out of antibiotics. Well, because it's the end of the antibiotic era, really. What I started the show with, when you apply force, you're going to get resistance, no matter what it is. And if we try and force, you know, the people to take vaccines, there's going to be resistance, and that's the good news. When you try and force a disease to change in some way, it's going to change. It's going to mutate, and you're not going to win the battle. The disease is going to win the battle. It's going to come back harder and stronger. And so that's what they're saying, that antibiotics are not going to be our savior anymore. And so, you know, you can think of the highest priority risks are the latest register include the deadly flu outbreak. We know a lot of that is a hoax. Catastrophic terrorist attacks, major flooding on the scale of 1953, last occasion on which a national emergency was declared in the UK. And it goes on and on and on. So this is part of the issue of drug resistance is what they're talking about. And that can go for viruses and bacteria like MRSA and things like that. So we're going to be looking at more, I guess, legal, the WHO taking over and calling the shots here. I'm not exactly sure. I thought it was an interesting article for people to hear that story.
Fascinating. You know, Debbie, with your permission, I'd like to actually just take a minute or two just to read through some of the article titles, because there's so many articles we don't have time to get to on the air here, and then the next week rolls around and so many more new articles have come up in the preceding week. I just wanted to give people a feel for some of the kinds of information that they can find on the news page of the Pandemic Response Project, and that's those three words all spelled out, pandemicresponseproject.com, and a news link in the upper right-hand corner. And if any of these articles you want to come back and talk about, elaborate on a little bit, of course, that would be terrific, Debbie. But I'm just going to skim through some from the last several days to give people a feel for the kind of information that's on the Pandemic Response Project. Here's an article from Natural News. Under-vaccinated children have better health. talking about that. Here's an article from a Dr. Sirkus, S-I-R-C-U-S, drsirkus.com. Is flu vaccine safe or dangerous for pregnant women? Because we keep hearing from the mainstream authorities that, oh, the vaccine is perfectly safe, and here's the study that proves it. But there's so much other information that shows exactly the opposite that they don't tell us about. So we need these alternative news articles to be more fully informed so we can make more informed decisions. Here's one of the rare instances where I go outside of the vaccine arena. Top psychiatrist, meds behind school massacres. And I've heard this idea from so many different sources over the last several days and a few weeks that a lot of these mass shootings, the people committing them are on one version or another of the psychotropic drugs, you know, for depression or other mental health conditions. And some of the side effects are that people become more violent when they take those drugs. So it's really an important issue here. Here's an article saying that evidence grows for narcolepsy link to the GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, swine flu shot. We've been hearing about this issue since 2009.
We've been talking about it.
And we've been talking about it, and more information just keeps coming up telling us that those swine flu vaccines, at least this particular one, was severely problematic, causing a just debilitating disability in children.
I don't know whether they have changed the vaccine to accommodate so that it's not occurring anymore. I don't really know.
Yeah, I don't have any information on that either. Here's one that's talking about Infanrix, which is an infant vaccine. They say kills and maims, but GlaxoSmithKline hid that from doctors and parents. Well, the pharmaceutical industry, of course, does try to downplay or cover up the adverse effects of its products because that's going to cut into their profits. There's articles, I've seen at least two or three articles recently talking about at least two court cases, vaccine injury cases, where the kids and the families were awarded millions of dollars over the lifetime of these children to take care of and treat their disability caused by vaccines, and kids that have autism or, you know, had autism. And we talked about this in the past where some people looked into the vaccine injury compensation program, and they found, I think it was 80-something cases of children who were compensated for vaccine injury by the federal government that had autism. So this notion that vaccines don't cause autism, we've had data showing that it does cause autism for a couple of decades now. And the CDC's response to that is, oh, well, we don't track those. We don't look at those cases, you know. That's not where we get our information from. Yeah, apparently not. So I don't want to just keep on going, but I just want to give folks a flavor for some of the things we're not going to have time to talk about today. But these articles are up there on the Pandemic Response Project if you want to look at them or any of the many other ones up there.
Well, that's great. And, you know, the reason that you have to just give those lists of titles is because news keeps happening. Every single week you have another 10 or more articles about things that are going on in the vaccine, exemptions, rights, waivers, and also health effects and cover-ups and all sorts of things that are going on. And we're here to explore that together. This show is just informative, educational, creating waves of awareness. It is not prescribing, diagnosing, or giving any legal advice. If you need health or legal care, then you have to see your provider. I wanted to make sure that people realize that. It's an important part of what we do here is get people to get motivated and start seeking questions or answers to their questions.
Thanks for that point of clarification, Deb, because, of course, we talk about a lot of medical and legal things here, and we're not intending to be dispensing advice in any formal sense. Boy, I think we're at the end of the hour, are we not?
The hour has come to a close, and hello, guests. We have some new guests who just signed in. I think I'm going to be continuing the discussion on my own. I'm going to be talking about Herbert Roberts, MD, The Principles and Art of Cure, using homeopathy by homeopathy, and I have been doing that for some time now, just going through his theory, philosophy, and instruction, that teaches how to use homeopathy to students or people who want to learn about it. What else do you want to just close with today for your part of the session, how they can get a hold of you and contact you if they have any needs?
Well, people can find me and contact information for me, as always, at vaccinerights.com. And there's a link there on the homepage of vaccinerights.com to the Pandemic Response Project. So you can get to all of my information from vaccinerights.com. Encourage people to visit the site. A lot of free information there about exemption and waiver rights and several different categories. E-book there if you want to go more in-depth in understanding your rights. And, of course, I'm available. People can email or call me with questions or concerns about their exemption and waiver rights. And I work with people with some minor exceptions all over the country. So happy to help. And, Debbie, of course, we can find you at homeopathyworldcommunity.com. Is that correct?
Yes, homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com if you wanted to contact me directly, or on the website. Every week I post new banners on the front page about upcoming shows. We're going to have Janie Goddard coming on the Monday live video stream Health In show and talking about revolutionary mind-body medicine. And she, go ahead and read the complete bio for her from the front page. And on Wednesday, we usually speak with Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim, a cardiologist in India who cares for all of his patients using homeopathy. He is like a guru of homeopaths, and he's amazing. So any kind of health question that you have, contact us, call in, chat. He usually answers questions from around the world. And Thursday, of course, is your show. We're always having sometimes special guest speakers, too. So if you have any ideas, send them to us. And you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter.
Sounds great. See you next week, Debbie.
Okay, bye-bye, Alan. And I'm going to go ahead and continue with today's show. I'm going to continue something that I've been working on with the group or listeners for some time now, and that is learning about homeopathy, learning how homeopathy works and the art of cure. Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD, has provided us with his notes, and I've been going chapter through chapter, first about what has homeopathy to offer to the young student who was just starting out in the medical field. What is the introduction to the study of homeopathy? Learning about the vital force. What is the energy within us, the spirit within us, that enlivens us and keeps us well and becomes weakened when we have some kind of toxin or impression, a germ, or just stress? There are all sorts of things that will affect us physiologically, emotionally, mentally. When you hear good music, you get into a state of being that might be less stressful, calming, soothing. When you hear something news that can be frightful or scary or upsetting, it's going to change your whole chemistry, your hormone system. You get into the fight or flight response, and that can weaken your vital force to the point of coming down with kind of symptoms. And he says homeopathy obviously will work the best when you have not gone into pathology, actual organ and tissue changes. So that's part of the beginning of what he teaches, the vital force as expressed in its functions, in health, in disease, in recovery, and cure. All of my readings and commentary are in past archived radio shows, so you'd have to go back among the hundreds of shows and seek them out. The vital energy in its universal application, that was chapter 5 of the book, and then homeopathy and fundamental laws, chapter 6. So homeopathy is science-based medicine. It is the first medicine using clinical trials, which we call in homeopathic speak provings, where healthy people took the energy of the medicine and documented what happened to them in their mind, body, and spirit. They would say what was going on, and then all of that was tabulated and organized and understood what was the different state from normal state into the new state that this, what we call an artificial disease by using these energy medicines, put the body into. So that's why this really works as a universal law. It works with the same laws as like gravity and physics and all different kinds of laws in the universe. Homeopathy works. And he explains that in chapter 7, our remedies and why they act. And then he begins to tell us how to take the case, how to analyze a case, and then he talks about the law of cure. How are you going to know and observe that the remedy selection you have given is actually helping the individual, either alleviating or palliating in a condition that is too far gone and the person doesn't have the vital force to continue? You know, you can see when a person is so weakened that they don't have that spirit inside of them to keep going and to actually throw off the disease. In that case, they just have a chronic disease, they live with it, and then you're just palliating or putting them in a state of comfort throughout that part of their life. So we have taking the case, the analysis of the case, and the law of cure, which means Herring's law, that what is the direction of law that you want to see? You want to see that the present symptoms, that the most recent symptoms, start to fade away as the older symptoms might come back into being, and you slowly peel that onion, you slowly see the curative action from inside out, everything from inside out and from the top down. Then chapter 11 was the chief complaint and the auxiliary symptoms in their relation to the case. So then we learn about what is it that the homeopath, the physician, needs to look at as what's the most important complaint. They might come in telling you it is one thing, but when you really take a deep consultation and understand where the person's coming from, you might find that there is something else that's really underlying the case. And if you have concomitants, if you have symptoms that are going on simultaneously, this is going to give you assuredness that you're on the right track to finding a good remedy. Chapter 12, you have the dynamic action of the drugs. So what is the action of the drugs, and what do you need to understand and learn about medicines, how they work, and what they produce in the individual? And now we're ready to move on to chapter 13, it's called the dose. And so Dr. Herbert Roberts says, in considering the amount of medicine to be used at one time or to answer the query, what constitutes a dose? And everyone, all homeopaths who are starting out want to know, what is the potency? How much do I give? When do I repeat? What dose do I give? So Dr. Roberts says it is very important to have some concept of the history of homeopathy, for this throws light upon the development of the problem of dosage. Therefore, you know, history repeats itself. You've got to look at history, no matter what it is, politically, socially, economically, in order to understand where you are in the present day. Before Hahnemann's time, and indeed in his early work, the dose played an important part. Nothing but crude and massive doses had ever been used in the case of the sick individual. All physicians used these massive doses as a matter of course. And Hahnemann, being a product of the best training of that day, followed in his early career in the footsteps of his predecessors. Even after Hahnemann began to see the light of the law of cure, which he talked about in a previous chapter, he continued to use massive doses. And it is to be remembered that he made cures with massive doses of crude medicine. But from that, he was obtaining continual experiments. He found that he was obtaining drug effects oftener than he was making a successful cure. So even today, we see using crude drugs, you know, if one aspirin isn't better, then take two aspirin. You know, the more is better concept doesn't really solve the problem because he found that he was getting what today we call in medicine side effects are really true effects of the medicine on the body, mind, and spirit of the individual. So if you give a drug for one thing and then they become suicidal or depressive, that's a real effect of the drug on the individual. So he was saying that even at the beginning of his career, Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, was using what his predecessors did, and that was crude drugs. When he became convinced of this, when he was became convinced that he was making more often drug effects and less often successful cures, he reduced the dose, dividing and again dividing the dose, watching closely the results. He soon found that the smaller the dose, the more beneficent the results. His experiments with the divided dose did not come until after he had discovered the dynamic action of disease. Then, with his logical mind, he must of necessity have correlated his results from the larger doses and brought his ideas of dosage into correlation with the same concept. 4. If disease be dynamic in nature, the use of a remedy to cure or even to reach the disease must be dynamic rather than physiological in form and power. What does that mean? It means that disease is a dynamic entity in nature. It changes. It only needs a small amount. You know, you think of how contagious disease you cough, you spray, and the minute particles, just a little bit of this energy touches and spreads the contagious disease. And so in the same way, the curative action must be in the same amount of power. Just what I said earlier in the show, that force, if you apply force, you're going to get resistance in the same amount of effort and energy. And so in the same way, if there is a disease that is dynamic and caused by a minimal amount of energy that impacted the body, mind, and spirit, then also the healative, curative action of medicine must be in a corresponding dose. So Dr. Herbert Roberts goes on to say, the more Hahnemann became convinced of the dynamic nature of disease, the more he sought the dynamic plane in medicine. And the more he sought the dynamic plane in medicine, and the more beneficial he found the administration of the similia, or the similar remedy, the similar disease. Very, very gradually, the minimum dose, which is always a flexible measure, became even smaller and smaller until it developed into the infinitesimal. And that is why people all around, the skeptics complain. They say there is nothing in it. Well, you can say that about a lot of things in nature. You can see, you open your eyes to the light, and that light changes the entire body's chemistry. You wake up, you come alive, you begin to bring on your day. You smell something that's wafting in from nature, some fragrance, some lilac bush or lavender. It changes who you are. You become calmed. These essences, these qualities, or if you smell, you know, somebody in the other room has vomited and it is quite repulsive. You know, how much of that odor do you need to get to change what you're feeling? So he found the minimal dose would be infinitesimal, to be dynamic. However, it has been a long road to the use of minimum dose, and many animosities have developed, all because of the failure of many minds to grasp the idea of the dynamic nature of disease and the natural tendency to look upon material substance as the remedy and the pathological state as the disease, and the failure to see the expression of disease states in subjective symptoms. So the subjective symptoms are what the patient, the client, the person who is ill is telling you they feel. So that is really, really important. And I was just listening to a show on public radio that says some guy had written a book, and he's really going to change medicine today, because the more doctors go into the digital world and have to just check boxes to make their diagnosis, the further away they are getting from hearing the story of the patient, the narrative of the person who's ill, to really understand what's going on in their life, their stresses, in order to find out what changed them into the disordered, the disease state from a normal, healthy state. And so objective symptoms, clinical lab results, okay, labels of diseases, okay, but if you don't have the subjective symptoms, you're going to fail to see the reality of that disease. Dr. Herbert Roberts goes on to say, the gradual recognition of the power of the minimum dose is manifest even in the dominant school of medicine and is being proven in the laboratories of modern science. As a result, gradually lessening doses are being adopted by many who have formerly derided the possibility of effectiveness of small doses. We even see that today in medicine with hormone replacement therapy. We used to give much cruder doses, much more micrograms, and now we see how important it is to reduce the doses of drugs. Many of the leading pharmacies have followed this road in preparing drugs for the use of the general physician. This trend is manifest in the colloidal preparations, and we know colloidal silver is now being used to ward off disease as an antibacterial, and the ductless gland therapy of his time. Of late, the physiologist has shown the power of vitamins. In a particular instance, we might point to recent experiments with vitamin D. Wow! Way back in the 1800s, Dr. Herbert Roberts is talking about vitamin D, and it's like big news today. Vitamin D to prevent influenza, to support the body, to support the immune system, all of our bodily functions. Way back then, he knew all about it. And why wasn't it common knowledge to physicians? It has been found that one part of the crystalline form to 3/1,000,000,000 has a curative action in rachitis, while 1 part to 50,000 has a destructive action to the point of causing rickets. This again verifies Hahnemann's dictum on the power of the small dose and the harmful effects of the more material dose, although this proven material would be classed as infinitesimal by many. So perhaps he's talking about an infinitesimal dose of vitamin D, the kind that we make in our bodies from getting out in the sunlight. This also demonstrates the Arz-Schultz law of action and reaction. So we are coming to a point where we fully recognize and comprehend the soundness of Hahnemann's deductions. Let us go to Hahnemann's Organon, the book that he wrote, 50 American editions at the time of this article, for his teaching in regard to the dose, remembering that in every edition this was plainly taught. Each edition progressed one step further in the development of the minuteness of the dose. So I'm not really sure whether he is referring to his 5th edition or his 6th edition of Hahnemann's Organon of Medicine, but it goes with paragraph 112, quote, he says, in older descriptions of the fatal effects of overdoses of medicines, it is often to be noticed that the close of such deplorable accidents, was marked by certain effects, which were of very different nature from those witnessed at the beginning of the case. These symptoms, which are called forth in opposition to the primary effect or actual operation of drugs upon the vital force of the organism, are its counter effect or after effect. But these are rarely, if ever, perceived after moderate doses administered to healthy persons for the purpose of experiment, and they are altogether absent after minute doses. During the homeopathic curative process, the living organism exhibits only that degree of counteraction against these minute doses, which is required to reestablish the natural state of health. So he's telling us that when taking a drug, taking a medicine, the effect upon the vital force is going to be, you're going to see at the close of this accident, of this overdose, you're going to see all the symptoms of the toxicity. You're going to see what happens to the body when you give it too much of something. And whereas, he says, if you give the dose as a homeopathic potency dosage, then you're not going to see the fatal effects. You won't see this pushback from the vital force, this after effect, this counter effect. Especially, he's even giving a description of giving it in, administering it to healthy persons for the person of experimentation, which is our provings. Paragraph number 128 of the Organon of Medicine says, the most recent experiments have taught that crude medicinal substances will disclose the same wealth of latent powers as when they are taken in a highly attenuated state, potentization by means of trituration and succussion. Through this simple process, the powers hidden and dormant, as it were in the crude drug, are developed and called into activity in an incredible degree. So let me say that one paragraph one, or aphorism number 128 of the Organon of Medicine, has said in recent experiences teaching that crude drugs, crude substances, will disclose the same wealth of latent powers as when they are taken in the highly attenuated, potentized state. So whether you are giving a drug in the crude form or in the potentized homeopathic form, you're going to uncover these hidden and dormant symptoms within the individual that will, the individual will be sensitive to displaying and expressing. Aphorism number 156. There is, however, scarcely a homeopathic remedy which, though well selected, if not sufficiently reduced in its dose, might not call forth at least one unusual sensation or slight new symptom during its operation on very susceptible and sensitive patients. So here again we see that, yes, we're acknowledging crude substances, crude drugs and medicine are going to absolutely force the body to perform in such and such a way to have symptoms or to suppress symptoms. However, homeopathic remedies can do a similar response in the body if they are not reduced to equal dynamic, an equal dynamis. And that is the beginning of his talk today about the dosage. You have to know that the disease has a dynamic, the medicines have a dynamic, and the body has a dynamic. And you're doing your best to match those levels so that you're not throwing anything out of whack. And I mean, you can just think of that in terms of physics, of spinning a top or anything else, that the amount of force that you apply is going to keep something spinning perfectly, or it's not going to be enough and it's going to drop, or it's going to be too much and you're going to throw it. You know, it's not going to spin very beautifully. It's going to just fly in the air and go somewhere. It's going to be too much and too harsh or too much of a dose of power. So now we're going to look at aphorism number 157. Although a homeopathically selected remedy, by virtue of its fitness and minuteness of dose, quietly cancels or extinguishes an analogous disease, aggravation caused by larger doses may last for several hours, but in reality, these are only drug effects, somewhat superior in intensity and very similar to the original disease. Okay, so I want to go back to aphorism 156. I wanted to emphasize in his aphorism the words susceptible and sensitive patients. So the more susceptible or sensitive you are to the remedy that is given, the more response and reaction you're going to have, depending upon if the dose is too much or too little, whether it is a crude dose or a homeopathic dose. And then aphorism number 157, he's saying that although homeopathically selected remedy by virtue of its fitness and minuteness, it will quietly cancel and remove the analogous disease, the symptoms that you are experiencing. So what happens when you have a right-on target match of potency, you're not going to realize that it's going to so quietly dissipate. The fluid in your lungs are going to just be absorbed and dissipate. Your coughing is going to quietly just go away, and you won't even notice that it was the response of the vital force, your own body, to the correct dose and the correct similimum of the remedy to enable your body to cure itself. Aggravation, he says, caused by larger doses, is going to last for several hours. So instead of medicinal doses, crude drug doses in allopathy causing a chronic illness, a chronic side effect to occur, if you just remove or don't repeat the dose homeopathically, you might have what's called this aggravation. And in reality, these are the drug effects that are somewhat superior in intensity, but they are very similar to your original disease, okay? So it's going to be the symptoms that you have are going to be a little bit intense, and then they're going to go away. Now we're going to look at aphorism number 159. The smaller the dose of the homeopathic remedy, so much the smaller and shorter is the apparent aggravation of the disease during the first hour. So this means that when you take a remedy, you're going to see something happen even within the first hour of the dosage. Aphorism number 160. The dose of homeopathic remedy can scarcely be reduced to such a degree of minuteness as to make it powerless to overcome and to completely cure an analogous natural disease of recent origin, and undisturbed by injudicious treatment. We may therefore readily understand why a less minute dose of a suitable homeopathic medicine an hour after its exhibition may produce an appreciable homeopathic aggravation of its kind. So let's look at this. The dose of the homeopathic remedy can scarcely be reduced to such a degree of minuteness as to make it powerless to overcome and to completely cure an analogous natural disease of recent origin and undisturbed by injudicious treatment. So he's saying even the smallest dose of homeopathic remedy is going to have an effect on the disease when it is analogous and it has not been tampered with by other kinds of treatments. We may therefore readily understand why this less minute dose of a suitable homeopathic medicine an hour after its exhibition may produce an appreciable homeopathic aggravation of this kind. So it, within the hour, if it is not the smallest dose possible, that will initiate a dynamic response within the person who is not well, is going to have some sort of an aggravation. Again, it is that force, that resistance of the body of physics coming into play. And I think that I may save the second half of this chapter, which is chapter number 13, called The Dose and the Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, by Herbert Roberts, MD, for the next session, because it is getting long, and I know people are probably ready to get on with their day. I do want to mention some of the things that you will find on Homeopathy World Community, some of the resources that you have. We just did have a show with Kate Birch and Scylla Watcott talking about homeoprophylaxis as a public health care model. I encourage you to take a look at that show. The archive is available on Homeopathy World Community. They have a book called The Solution, Homeoprophylaxis, The Vaccine Alternative. And they have trained 300 physicians, homeopaths, to get with their program and help parents who are interested in an alternative to the vaccination issue. We also have the ASEA water. It's the redox signaling molecules that will help the cells and bodies in your body to repair. It is NaCl. It is salt water, just like a bit of the ocean. And people are finding this very, very helpful in their healing journey. And there is a link to that on the front page, on all the pages of Homeopathy World Community. If you are a healthcare provider, if you are a student of homeopathy, if you are just a student of health, and if you are a practitioner, a nurse, a physician, an acupuncturist, a chiropractor, you may want to take a look at the program called Complete Dynamics in Homeopathy. There is a link to that, a banner on the page. I use this almost every single day to study the Materia Medica, the Encyclopedia of Drugs and Medicines, to input the rubrics into the repertory of symptoms in order to come up with an analysis and understand the case, the client's case, and find the most similar, the similimum for that individual. And it is a great study tool. It's a great resource if you are a professional to get Complete Dynamics in as a program. We also have Dr. Otto coming in on Wednesdays to talk with us about heart health and his life experience in the clinic and hospital with patients. We have Kavitha Kukunur, a homeopath. She just posted a brand new article, a cured case, on Homeopathy World Community called A Case of Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. And what the what remedy she chose and how she chose it, it's really fascinating. She is a great inspiration and author. There's so much available. And I have one more thing. If you're interested at all, then you're going to have to contact me directly. And that is for a purity water that cleans your water when you drink it, whether you're in a place where you're traveling and there is some kinds of contaminated water from bacteria, from toxins, effluents from industry, and you want to be able to feel secure and safe about drinking your water, they have a purity water bottle. You can even call Werner Berger. And he has provided his phone number for those who want it. You'll have to contact me, but Werner Berger has been following my work on the Health In Show and Blog Talk Radio. He's willing to offer a 20-minute consultation to our listeners and our viewers. You can call and set up a time. He will answer your questions in his own inimitable way. Werner Berger is one of the oldest men to have conquered the seven summits. Recently, he climbed Mount Everest at the age of 75, and he did not use any enhancing drugs to do that. He believes and credits his success to be a balanced lifestyle, exercise, diet, and high-quality nutritional supplements. I know you'll want to get a chance to speak to him. If you do, email me at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com, and I will get you in touch with him to talk about all of these products that are available to everyone. Okay, so we are just going to end today's show. I want to thank you so, so much. It's Thursday, which means that you're going to be coming up to your glorious weekend. I want you to have a fabulous time. Get out there, walk in the sunshine, think about drinking some clean water, cleanse your body. If you're doing a fast, I know you're going to want that water. And think about positive things. Let's improve the world together, creating waves of awareness. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Your truth be unfurled, one by one.